Today's Dead Idea? Well, this is the next installment for our continuing series on Titoism. Now, if you know anything at all about the Balkans region, you know its tendency to break apart into ethnic nationalities all vying against one another. But somehow, Tito managed to hold it together as one country for damn near 40 years. How did he do that? Today we're talking to the host of the History of Yugoslavia podcast, Alex Cruikshanks, in order to find out how Tito managed to quote-unquote solve the national question. That's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. We have a special guest today. Alex, thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Brendan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I was glad that we were able to do this. It's always fun to get other podcasters, you know, and connect up our audience and just kind of like get a different perspective. So
yeah,
this will be great. So Alex Cruikshanks, and Alex, interrupt me at any point here, right, if I get this wrong or anything else today, okay? Alex Cruikshanks hosts the History of Yugoslavia podcast, which I've mentioned before on this show. It is chock full of information. It's a great place to learn more, especially if you want the perspectives of the other nationalities in the region. In this series, we have been taking the Slovenian perspective in particular, but you can hear about the Serbs, the Bosnians, the Croats, the Montenegrins, the Macedonians, and more on Alex's show. So definitely check that out. And that's also kind of why we're here today, because for this topic in particular, we're really going to need a wider perspective. Our topic today is the national question, as they called it, or the near intractable problem of having a peninsula chock full of ethnicities who have all developed their independent national identities and ramped them up to a fever pitch, and then somehow they're supposed to work together as one nation, as one people, as one Yugoslavia. not an easy task. So prior to World War I, basically the peninsula was imploding on itself. After World War I, a United Kingdom of Yugoslavia was set up, but everyone understood this as really little more than a thin veil for Serb domination. I mean, Yugoslavia itself means South Land of the Slavs. Yugoslavs means South Slavs, right? So it's an identity that's supposed to be unified for everybody, but it just didn't work out that way under the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, and that identity got tainted, so to speak, with the idea of Serb domination. So it was kind of ruined. But after World War II, when Tito kept the Yugoslavia thing going and set up a united communist Yugoslavia, somehow he managed to hold it together. For a span of more than 35 years, depending on how you count, the national question was really not that much of a thing. Not nearly so much compared to before or after, because no sooner than Tito died in 1980, it all started to fall apart again. And as we're all too familiar with, by the 90s, the Yugoslav War ravaged the region, and you got Milosevic, you got Sarajevo, and all of that nightmare, which gives the sense of Tito really having been this kind of Atlas-like titan holding up the world, as it were, and with him gone, it just all comes tumbling down. So Alex, basically the question that we're going to be at pains to answer today is, was Tito really just that much of a titan, or was it a whole lot more complicated than that? And we'll leave our conclusions for that question till the end of the episode, but that's where we're going with this today. So what do you think? Are you ready to go?
just as a sort of starting thought to, like, as an answer to that general question, just for people to be thinking about through the episode.
Sure.
While, yeah, sure, Tito is a very charismatic leader who defines the country in a sense. But does that mean the country has to collapse after he dies? I don't think so. After all, for example, Mao was a very defining leader in Chinese history. The Chinese state was centered around him, but it didn't collapse after he died. The Soviet Union didn't collapse after Stalin died. They both continued functioning for another, well, in the Soviet Union's case, for another 40 years or so, and in China's case, for 40 years and counting. Whereas Tito, it all collapsed within 10, 15
years.
So I think there's got to be more to it.
Good point. Well, we'll get into that today. So let's start off with, so it's kind of a conversation, but kind of an interview. So I'm going to ask some questions and get your perspective. And together, between our research that we've done, we'll meet somewhere in the middle. So the first thing that I want to ask is, so we have to provide basically the context for the ethnic divisiveness that's just endemic to the Southeast Europe region that we're talking about. And we've already covered this in depth multiple times on this show, first in our Balance of Power series episode on the Balkan situation, then again in this series. But for listeners who may be tuning in for the first time, and you know, because this is so key, we do have to set the stage a little bit. So if we could just very briefly paint a picture of, like, what was the deal with the Balkans and their ethnic divisiveness? What was going on prior to Tito's time that made this such a difficult area to work with?
Well, I'd say that the main cause of the sort of ethnic divides in the Balkans is the fact that much of them were previously part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. And the Ottomans sort of had a policy called the millet system, in which they segregated religious communities into political communities, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you are defined by whether you are Orthodox or Catholic or Muslim. And so when they emerge from this Ottoman environment, they still see themselves to a sense as defined by those communities. And the Orthodox Christians become Serbs, the Catholic Christians become Croats, and the Muslims become Bosniaks eventually.
Well, that's an interesting point to raise. And it's not something that I actually raised earlier in this series. That's great. And it reminds me also of what you can see very, very much today in a country like Malaysia. I spent a year in college in Malaysia, and they have a country that's very much divided along ethnic lines between Malays, Chinese, and Tamil Indians. And again, that's a country exactly like that, where although it's maybe not completely governmentally institutionalized with a system like the millet system, like, your ethnic identity also defines your religion.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you are ethnically a Malay, then you are by default a Muslim, and the Muslim police of the country can punish you for not, I'm not sure what kind of infractions would be punishable, but for not being a good Muslim. You can be brought in on certain things. And it doesn't matter if you say, well, I'm actually not a Muslim, I'm just Malay. Like, that question would not compute for them. And I suspect it may have been the same in the Balkans region.
It was similar in the Ottoman period. Like, if you were an Orthodox Christian, for example, you were subject to the jurisdiction of the Orthodox bishops and the hierarchy in Constantinople.
Well, excellent. So basically, the situation when Tito comes on the stage is like all these ethnicities that are very much defined rigidly as completely different.
Yeah.
And then somehow they have to pull together.
There is still an element that's been going on since the mid-19th century of this idea of Yugoslavism, that while they are while all the South Slavic peoples may be different tribes is a word they like to use, they're all one people in another sense.
Yeah, I did read about that. I got the impression that that was never more of a minority view, though.
It was an intellectual view, I'll just put it that way. Yeah.
Which always tend to be minority views.
Yeah. Yeah. But then at the time, most people couldn't read, so.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so good. All right, so that's setting the stage, right? Okay, now, on to Tito, right? So, the thing about Tito, when you read Tito's speeches, and I got this whole book full of Tito's speeches, that was just awful. Tito's speeches were great, but the book was produced so terribly. It's just like, they barely have a copyright date in the book, and then it's just like a table of contents and a bunch of things copied and pasted from the internet. But be that as it may, when you read these speeches, he nearly always starts by invoking the glories of the War of Liberation, or in other words, World War II, and the partisan movement. And whenever he brings up the national question, he is very quick to state that this question was, quote-unquote, already solved during the war with the partisan movement. So what's up with that? I mean, so we just go straight from the situation we just described, then The Axis powers invade Yugoslavia, he starts his resistance movement, and suddenly they've solved the question already?
Yeah.
That just seems like, to me, when I read that, it sounds like political rhetoric. But I wonder, to what extent was it actually addressed and maybe overcome already during the partisan movement, during the war?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, for a start, you've got to remember that these people are all hardline communists, and because these guys are communists, essentially, they really want to push this idea that nationalism is part of capitalism, therefore when they've moved beyond capitalism, they've dealt with it, nationalism is no longer important, we can move on to the next thing, which is the building the road towards communism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That said, there is an element of the sort of the partisan struggle during the war which provides a basis for a multi-ethnic state. For example, it does accept members from all ethnicities, which none of the other armies in Yugoslavia during the war did.
Including the other resistance armies, like the Chetniks was mostly Serbs,
right? Chetniks was almost entirely Serb. And this was true right up to the top. For example, like Tito was himself, he was a Croat, but the other leading figures in the partisans for people like Edward Kardel, he was a Slovene.
Tito was actually half Slovene, actually.
Yeah, so he was already mixed.
Croat
father, Slovene mother, yeah.
Exactly, yep.
Then there was also Milovan Djilas, who was a Montenegrin, and Alexander Rankovic, who was a Serb, and Moshe Piade, who was a Jew.
Give our listeners like a sense of what that is, especially those listening in America, where ethnicity is not really anywhere near the same as it was in this region, it's a lot closer to how Americans might feel about race.
Yeah.
So it would be like saying, like, the top cabinet of the president is composed of an African American, a Native American, an Asian American, etc. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say that's probably right. It's just it's a similar dynamic. It's just that in racial terms, it's manifested in terms of physical appearance, whereas in ethnic terms, it's either in terms of religion or language or
clearly. Yeah. So basically, in other words, during the war, you've got two things. First of all, it's open to everybody.
Yeah.
His movement, at least, is open to everybody, right? And do you know if their units were actually mixed or not?
To an extent, yeah. It became more mixed through the war. At the start, the partisans were mostly Serbs, but over time, more and more of the other ethnicities joined up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so having mixed units, or at least an overall resistance movement that you know is comprised of other ethnicities, even if they're not shoulder to shoulder with you, you get that sense of a shared trauma that's a very powerful for binding groups together.
Yes, though this just leads into the other half of this, which is the sort of memory, the institutional memory of this conflict within Tito's Yugoslavia, which paints it as a very black and white, simplistic conflict of the partisans fighting against fascism. Of everyone in Yugoslavia joining the partisans and fighting against fascism, which sort of very much glosses over all of the other complexities of all of the other armies in the war. It goes hand in hand with there's a reluctance to look too closely into the past and go into too much detail. For example, at the end of the war, when the Yugoslavian delegations go to the peace conference, they present an estimate of the number of dead in Yugoslavia during the war of 1.7 million.
Okay.
And it was widely accepted at the time, both at the time and later, that they'd slightly exaggerated this, and it was probably more like about 1.1 million, but they said it to get more compensation from the Germans, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah. But no one wanted to look into what the real figure was after the war, because that would mean looking into who killed who, essentially. That would mean, like, how many people did the Ustasha kill? How many people did the Chetniks kill? Which was a can of worms no one wanted to open.
Yeah. Speaking of the Ustasha, I think that's key to our talk of today as well. So can you say anything about what the Ustasha was?
The Ustasha was this essentially Croatian version of the Nazis is a simplistic way to put them. When the Nazis invaded Yugoslavia, they installed this incredibly extreme right wing Croat nationalist party called the Ustasha in power in a puppet state, which covered all of modern Croatia and Bosnia, and the Ustasha essentially set about massacring Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies.
And my impression is before the Nazis moved in, the Ustasha might have been like a fringe movement, but wasn't like by any means a popular majority movement.
No, certainly not. There was an effort to sort of co-opt more moderate Croat nationalist leaders, which met with varying degrees of success. But yeah, these aren't mainstream political figures or mainstream Croat nationalists. They are very much on the extreme of the extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then being put in power, then they start doing atrocities against other ethnicities. I think the Serbs in particular, and that is going to come back in a big way at the end of our story today.
Yeah.
Before we move on, I do have a figure on Tito's partisans being open to all nationalities. What I found, and don't quote me on this as being the exactly perfect statistics, because internet is perfectly reliable, as we all know. 44% Serb, 30% Croat, 10% Slovene, 5% Montenegrin, 2.5% Macedonian, and 2.5% Bosnian Muslim is what I found.
Yeah, I'd guess that's probably a figure closer to the end of the war than the start of the war, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
The other thing I wanted to mention was, since we're focusing on this show on the Slovene war, the Slovene experience, what I found as far as the Slovenian war experience was, it was kind of unique among Yugoslav areas in being sort of divided up by four different invaders: the Nazis, the Italians, the Hungarians, and then those Ustashi Croatians, and actually annexed by them. It's a little bit of a murky political difference between being occupied and annexed. But as I understand it, the idea was there was the threat of the Slovene lands like not being a thing at all after the war, just being completely absorbed into those countries, divided up and so on. So it was perhaps more of a threat of being extinguished as a people than the other areas? That was the impression that I got. I don't know. What do you think?
I think there's certainly some truth in that, though I'd also say there's some truth in that in the Croatian experience as well, because there were a lot of Croats who joined the partisans, essentially because they feared that the Ustasha had compromised the idea of Croatia as a separate thing, and that Croatia was going to be absorbed into a unitary Yugoslavian state at the end of the war. So yeah, in both the Slovenian and the Croatian cases, they're seeking to avoid the complete, and I guess in the Macedonian case as well, there's an effort to avoid the complete destruction of their national entity.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that's always the question, but it's to different degrees, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's interesting that you say that the Ustasi might have led to the elimination of the whole identity of the Croatian people or the separateness of them, because I bet that the Ustasi thought exactly what they were doing was promoting. That's what I would have expected. Okay, so anyway, all right, so that's during the war. So basically, sounds like what we're coming to for conclusions here is, yeah, there might have been some basis for solving the national question during the war. And part of it was being shoulder to shoulder to some extent with other ethnicities and having that shared traumatic experience. And the other part of it is the sort of communist ideology of identifying by class, not by state or ethnicity or nationality or things, but like we are all one communist movement, all one, you know, workers' party.
That's true, though this is often undermined at the same time. Like, for example, I'm going to make a comparison here with the Soviet Union. What Stalin does when he comes to power is he proclaims the we don't need to solve the national question anymore. But then what he sets about doing is giving everyone ID cards, telling them what ethnicity they are, and organizing them into specific ethnic areas and zones. which is why Armenia and Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan emerged from the Soviet Union. Obviously, when you do that, you aren't discouraging a sense of ethnicity, you're preserving it, really.
That does make sense. Yeah.
And it's a similar story in Yugoslavia. Sorry.
Yeah, definitely, but for different reasons, I think. Because in Yugoslavia, and now we're kind of moving into Tito's time as president after the war. Mm-hmm. In Yugoslavia, it was more a recognition that we probably just can't take this situation and make everybody forget that they had different identities. We're gonna have to have some kind of a recognition of that within a united federation.
That's
my impression.
They set up these six republics and later two autonomous areas within Yugoslavia. And officially, the constitution declares that they have the right to self-determination. But everyone knows that they're never actually supposed to do anything with this right. This is on paper. No one is ever actually. Tito doesn't think anyone is actually ever going to split away from Yugoslavia, ironically. So that's a way of providing a sop to the nationalists without actually giving them anything in practice.
Well, I don't know. Maybe at first Tito kind of had that attitude, but I feel like as he went through, there was more and more deference paid to the different republics and their different nationalities, and to the extent, like, maybe even to some extent too much. But that's a question to get into later.
It does decentralize over the 60s and 70s.
Exactly. So let's go ahead, officially move on then to his time as president. So after the war, the power that's left over of the local Yugoslavs is primarily Tito's partisan movement. And so a communist dictatorship is set up. Tito is in power. He is a war hero. Everyone falls in line under him because that's what you do when you have a war hero. Everybody can rally around you, and that's what the definition of a leader, right? And he filled that role. He was excellent at it, and so great. He was able to take power, right? But then immediately. The first thing that happens when you've all come together to fight against a common enemy and then the enemy is removed, you remember, oh yeah, we all hated each other before the war. But he managed to hold it together. So, I mean, how do you think he did that? One thing you mentioned he gave each nationality its own republic within the federation. And the two autonomous districts that you mentioned, that was... I think it's pronounced Vojvodina or Vojvodina.
Vojvodina, yeah.
Vojvodina, which it's adjacent to the Serbian Republic and was the center of Serbs under the Habsburgs, as I understand it.
Yes, Serbia north of the Danube, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And then Kosovo, which was mostly Albanian, but recently conquered by Serbs. So that's kind of what made them different, as I understand it.
The justification for this was that Hungarians and Albanians already had their own states in separate countries. Mm-hmm. Though the other reason for this was to appease the Serb nationalists who wanted to keep these areas as part of Serbia, essentially. So they were kept as nominally part of Serbia rather than being called separate republics.
Okay. So not being given the status of entirely separate republics, but rather autonomous units, then they're nominally Serbian. Okay, that's interesting, because what I actually read for the justification of it was a check on Serb power, as if the Serbs would have been overpowering had they had those regions entirely within them.
That's a motivation behind it as well. It provides a couple of extra votes in the federal institutions against the Serbs, against Serbia. Yep.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
What else do you... So that's one thing, right? But that's not enough. Like, how did he hold this together? What would you say was the biggest thing?
Well, for a start, I'd say we shouldn't fall too much into the sort of prejudice about the Balkans of assuming different ethnic groups means conflict. For example, Switzerland is a multi-ethnic country, yet it hasn't ever had a civil war. In the Balkans itself, you could go down to Albania, which has exactly the same religious divisions as in Bosnia. Part of the population is Muslim, part of the population is Catholic, and part of the population is Orthodox. And the Albanian religious tensions are more or less non-existent. It's very religiously harmonious in Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But why doesn't that happen in Yugoslavia? I'd say it's more a case of why do people other than Tito try to push this idea of polarization and nationalism? Mm-hmm. If that makes sense, it's reversing the question almost of not why did Tito hold it together, but why did the people after Tito try to tear it apart? Why did Milosevic and Tudjman set on pulling this country apart?
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So let's use the same question, but put it in the time period that we're in here, so mm-hmm. right after the war.
Yeah.
Because there was, he did have to keep quite mm-hmm. a tight control on ethnic nationalism that kind of continued to keep popping up, but he out of the many things that he could have exerted powerful restriction on and didn't, that was the one that he really did. And in this series, we heard from a Montenegrin man named Srđan Perisic, who did an interview with us, who definitely underlined that tight control. And so if you were, for example, starting to speak out as a nationalism for your particular people, you wouldn't necessarily be jailed, but you might be frozen out of society. Yeah. Find it difficult to get a job, find it difficult to, you know, establish ties or connections in any way that would make you functional in society. So so there was this nationalism that was just ready to emerge at any given point that he had to be actively policing of.
Well, he's in a situation where it's easy to get legitimacy to prosecute and marginalize nationalist political leaders. Because you can just say you're a Ustasha, you're a Chetnik, and mm-hmm. yeah, and we've just fought a war to defeat you, so shut up. Yeah, you lost. Get over it. There's also the general. This is Stalinist style. I'm reluctant to call it Stalinist, but similar to Stalinist. Authoritarianism, where you imprison or marginalize anyone who's a political enemy just because that's what you do in authoritarian regimes.
Yeah. Which happened quite a bit, especially at the beginning of mm-hmm. his term, right after the war. I read anywhere between 10 and 15,000 executed without trial, mm-hmm. another 10 or 15,000 sent to the Goli Otok prison, as a prison island. It was basically like a gulag.
Yeah. There was a lot of show trials as well.
Okay. So the next thing that I really found is that when we get to about 1966, then what's going on in the development of Yugoslav communist ideology is they're moving to a market economy, and this gets opposed by a guy named Rankovic.
I mentioned him earlier. He was sort of the main Serbian figure within the partisan movement, and probably the highest ranking Serb in the Communist Party after the war.
Mm-hmm. And he gets painted as a Serb nationalist, but at least according to the author that I was reading about him, he may have just been strongly devoted to the idea of a centralist government rather than a particularly Serbian, but he was so Serbian himself, and so connected with that, I guess, in people's minds, or easily connected by people who wanted to smear him, that it was spun that way.
Yeah.
And then he was dismissed after this big scandal about did he or did he not bug Tito's bedroom. Somebody did, but whether he directly ordered it was a bit of a controversy.
Yeah. For, whatever the answer is, it's probably just an excuse for political dissimilarities. In terms of whether he was a Serb nationalist or just a centralist, you're right to say that they can somewhat get mixed up a bit, and they got mixed up all the way through the history of Yugoslavia as an idea right back to the 19th century. For there were a lot of Serb nationalists in the 19th century who saw the idea of Yugoslavia as basically Greater Serbia by the back door. Essentially,
Greater Serbia was like, that was a thing, that was the term, right? Yeah. That was the whole idea.
Yeah. For example, you've probably heard of Gavrilo Princip, the guy who assassinated Franz Ferdinand and
kicked off World War One. Yeah.
Yeah. His group, Young Bosnia, they were a Yugoslavist group, but they were being supplied and, I guess you could say, manipulated by a more openly Serb nationalist group. In Serbia, called the Black Hand, but
the Black Hand, yeah, my favorite terrorist organization name ever. Definitely. So basically, I mean, the point here is really that we had this cropping up again of this idea that what they call chauvinism, or this kind of like promotion of your own ethnic group to the exclusion of others, is being a continuing problem here, and it's addressed in as part of this Rankovic scandal, where he gets dismissed, and it's like there's going to be changes, and there were some changes to do with how the police system worked, which Rankovic had been in control of, but it's a problem that whenever you hear Tito say it, it's like the national question is solved. And it always was solved ever since the war. We've all pulled together and it's all brotherhood and unity. But it keeps popping up like these weasels in a game. You like try to hit him with a hammer and they just keep coming up, you know?
Well, it's an easy way to, there's an extent to which it's an easy way to have a different, it's a different way of getting political power, essentially, because you're appealing to something different from the Marxist theory that that the Communist Party officials are all appealing to. They're all appealing to the same thing. So if you appeal to nationalism, you look different in a way, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And one way that's distinctly of a different context and flavor than we might be used to in Western countries is, like, in America, for example, you can have kind of a nutty fringe movement and they can spout whatever toxic and poisonous ideology that they want, and it's not necessarily going to take down the system or cause, like, an uprising or massive violence, but it very well could have in a place like this. Mm-hmm. And it also they had a single-party system, and Tito was very much in favor of continuing a single party system. He allowed different republics and the different ideas of different local allowed some local autonomy in terms of how they want to institute things, right? But he was not by any means allowing like the Green Party, the Democrats, the Republicans, the parties from your side of the pond, the Tories and the what's the other one,
the Labour Party,
yeah, and so on, yeah. So it was not that kind of situation at all.
No,
right?
No, it's very much a classically one party state. There is one dominant party, which in this case is Communist Party, of course, and other parties can exist if they basically agree not to challenge the Communist Party, to just go along with whatever it says, and to form one list with it in the elections, so there are no actually contested elections. So essentially, it's the kind of thing. It was similar in a lot of other Eastern Bloc states. You'd walk into the voting booth, you'd see a ballot, and it has, here are the candidates of the Communist Party, here are the candidates of the allied parties, or the Social Democrats, or whoever had agreed to ally with the Communist Party, mm-hmm. and you'd vote yes or no, and that would be it. And of course you didn't vote no, because then you would be caught by the police. so you went in, you voted yes to the candidates presented to you, and that was it.
Yeah, quite an election.
Yeah.
So the other thing about this whole situation, so we're focusing mainly on Rankovic right now, as being the guy who opposed this turn toward the market economy. But market economy reform does go through, and one consequence of that is that the various enterprises of the country are allowed to basically sink or swim on a not quite capitalist, but somewhat similar to capitalist principle. Suck, you just kind of go out of business.
I should probably explain it, expand on this, because Yugoslavian socialism is quite different to what it was like in the Soviet Union or in East Germany mm-hmm. or any state like that. Initially, it was very similar to that, but from about the late 50s onwards and to about 66, as you say, they start introducing this idea of what they call a socialist market economy, which is essentially mm-hmm. where they have these cooperative sort of worker/state-owned companies, but mm-hmm. they compete against each other on a market basis. So they aren't mm-hmm. privately owned; they're still collectively owned by their employees, but they do have a market competition against each other. They're not working in terms of Stalin-style 5-year plans, for instance.
Right. Yeah. And one of the consequences of this is, for the first real time in the history of communist Yugoslavia, you start to get an unemployment problem.
Yeah.
And it's uneven in terms of which parts of the country that it hits. It's far worse in the south, mm-hmm. where enterprises have traditionally been less efficient than it is in the north, especially northwest, places like Slovenia and Croatia, that had sort of a different cultural capital inherited from their different history. Mm-hmm. And they just had a leg up in terms of that kind of business, in terms of how their culture dealt with business. And consequently, I could easily see how that would have been seen as a kind of ethnic favoritism. So I'm sure that that did not help the national question at all.
Obviously, Slovenia and Croatia were richer in the first place, essentially because they were near the center of Europe, where there's more trade, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were less ravaged by the World War. Well, Slovenia in particular was less ravaged by World War II, so it had less to. Had less damage to build up back from after the war. And as the decentralization starts to take hold in the 60s and 70s, there's a sense in the local bureaucracy, in the republic bureaucracies with it, because obviously mm-hmm. they're each a republic. And I wouldn't say it's nationalist at this point. It's more like a self-interested viewpoint mm-hmm. in which Slovenia doesn't want to give up the money that it gains so it can be spent in Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Because Kosovo is much poorer, exactly. And essentially they want to spend it on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So and an obvious way to justify that is to adopt nationalist language.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you say Slovenia didn't want to give up their own money to be spent on some other part of the country, I think that to a certain extent, many people in the West, certainly in America, can identify with that. Like, I earned this money with my own hands, I should be able to enjoy it. But there was a very different idea going on at the time of, like, we are all one people, this is a socialist country in which we all pull together, we're all part of the same, you know, workers' collective, essentially, and everyone should be equal. So it's equality in two different senses. Equal opportunity on the one hand to succeed or fail by your own hand versus equality of conditions on a much more like everybody has the same kind of idea.
That's true, but it's also in a sense that I'd say it's an it's less about individual jealousy and more about kind of a collective jealousy within different groups. For example, it's the best way I could approximate in America is say people in in New York who object to their taxes being spent in Utah, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That might be completely wrong. I might be getting that very badly wrong, but
Well, no,
yeah.
there is stuff like
Yeah.
that. And even on a much smaller scale, like our schools, for example, are funded by the property taxes in just the districts where like that school
Yeah.
is, right?
Yeah.
So if you've got a lot of wealthy people in a certain little district, their school is going to get a lot of funding,
Yeah.
and therefore their children are going to get a considerably better education than the next one over, where it's quite a poor region and the school can't afford crap,
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? So,
So I guess
and then it's a
the
self-perpetuating cycle.
Yeah. So I guess the best equivalent of what starts to happen, particularly in the 1980s, is people in Slovenia start to say, "So why should Slovenes give up what they produce to pay for Serbs and Albanians?" Is it, it so? Imagine if a New York politician came up and said, "Oh, the New York people, as a separate entity, don't want to pay for Alabamans anymore." Yeah, but because in the US there's a much vaguer sense of ethnicity, the idea that New Yorkers constitute a separate race would be laughed at. It wouldn't be taken seriously. Whereas in Slovenia, it was taken very seriously.
Right, exactly. Other things that I found during this time period that was kind of interesting was that one of the things about Yugoslavia as a communist country is you weren't prevented from traveling abroad. And in fact, a lot of people went abroad,
No.
particularly during the 60s and 70s, not just for travel, but to work as Gastarbeiters or like
Yeah. Guest
part-time
workers,
workers
yeah.
or guest workers.
Yeah.
Yep, guest workers. And one of the things that I found about that is in other countries, they would often go to clubs that are run by expats from their own region, such as Serbs and Croats. And those Serbs and Croats, not being in Tito's Yugoslavia, would have a much freer ability to speak their own minds. And there's a lot of nationalist radicalist rhetoric that got picked up in those clubs in other countries. And then later, when the economic boom in Europe that had kind of led to this whole Gastarbeiter movement kind of petered out, then many of these workers would come back to Yugoslavia and be full of this this same kind of rhetoric, this kind of ethnic dissent, and they
Yeah.
brought it back home with them.
At the same time, I'd say that the diasporas, the people who are likely to be in the diaspora, who people who aren't in Tito's Yugoslavia, are likely to have a reason that they weren't there, and that reason was quite often that they, or more likely their parents by this point, had been ustashas or chernyks. Yeah, and that isn't entirely true, but there was a strong suspicion that that was the case. For example, the man who became independent Croatia's first foreign minister, Gojko Šušak, who was a notoriously right-wing, hardline nationalist. His parents had both been ustashas, and he'd spent virtually his entire life living in Canada. Yeah, he had very little experience of Tito's Yugoslavia.
That makes, yeah, of course that makes sense. Yep, they would, the people who had been outside the country would have a reason having been there, and therefore also probably a reason to not be particularly favorably disposed towards how things are being run in Yugoslavia. We in fact, we heard from someone just like that who had to flee to Canada in one of our interviews earlier. His father had to flee for no greater reason than basically requesting to stay in civil service rather than having to go into the military compulsory service. And then he found out then he was on a list and he feared for his life and he had to smuggle him and his family out of the country. So yeah, there were reasons. I mean, that's a good point. There were reasons why people were outside the country and spouting this kind of particular kind of
It's
rhetoric.
not a perfect analogy, obviously, but it's like there are a lot of Germans in Argentina and Brazil after the war. They aren't the nicest people in the world, I'm sure you can. Yeah. I'm sure you can figure out why they're there.
Yes. So all of this kind of builds through the 60s and especially in the 70s. You get, in 1971, you get Croatians even proposing things like Croatians should only serve militarily in Croatia, ideas like that. And Tito starts to, you know, he's picking up on this, and he starts to warn that this kind of disorder is going to be taken advantage of by outside powers. And you know what? He's not going to let that happen. He would rather impose order by the army than allow another country's army to do so. And I found an interesting quote where he actually predicts that Yugoslavia might fall after he's gone, which I'd like to go to here. Yeah, okay. So here he says, this is in Zagreb, July 1971. He says, "Do we want to have 1941 again? Are you aware that others would immediately be present if there were disorder? I'd sooner restore order with our own army than allow others to do it. We've lost prestige abroad, and it will be hard to get back. They are speculating that, quote, when Tito goes, the whole thing will collapse, unquote, and some are seriously waiting for that. The internal enemy has plenty of support from outside. The great powers will use any devil that will work for them, whether communist or not. All kinds of things are being said. It is even being said among you that I invented my conversation with Brezhnev in order to frighten you and force you into unity." So there he's quoting somebody else who predicted that things would fall apart after Tito. Mm-hmm. But I get the impression that he's posing that as a real possibility.
Well, first to say, in 1971, he's saying this right at the height of what was known as the Croatian Spring, this protest movement against the Yugoslavian government in Belgrade. And this mixes together a lot of quite disjointed opposition. Some of it is just normal liberal democratic opposition who want to see a more liberalized political system. But invariably, there are Croatian nationalists who get mixed in as well, and Tito is picking on that in particular as something to attack. But be aware that this is a quite a particular point in time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when absolutely. Croatia is looking particularly rebellious.
Okay, so the next thing that crops up then is around 1974, people start to wonder for real what's going to happen when Tito dies, including Tito himself. And it's called the succession issue. Yeah. So what kind of system are we going to set up? Is there going to be just another charismatic dictator that's going to, you know, just carry on his legacy and do the same thing in his place? Or are we going to do something different? And what's originally set up, as far as my research turned up, is a kind of collective presidency with representatives of all republics, including each major nationality within each republic. So, for example, Bosnia has mainly, it has the, what are the three major ones? So it's the Muslims and the...
Yeah, well, it's just Croats and Serbs are recognized as ethnicities within Bosnia. Muslims are not recognized at first, and so they mostly choose, on the census questions, when they ask, what ethnicity are you, they either don't answer the question, or they say they are Yugoslavs. Which is an option you can say. You can say you're a Yugoslav rather than any particular ethnicity. And then in the early 60s, they introduced the opportunity for you to say you are what they call a Muslim by nationality, that your nationality is Muslim. Now, most of them don't want to say this. Most want to call themselves Bosniaks, which is what they call themselves now.
Right. But, okay, so basically you've got three major nationalities within Bosnia. So they have to have three representatives, which means they also give three representatives to each of the other republics, and then two to each of the autonomous ones. So you end up with something like 23, I think, including Tito, representatives all acting collectively as a president in this system. And it's like, if you've ever worked on a committee, you know that that might not be the best idea. Yeah.
Eventually, they do boil it down to... They do set up a sort of state council which has one representative from each republic and autonomous region, but that's still eight people. So
it's still pretty unwieldy. And the other thing that just spelled death for this system was each republic was given a veto.
Yeah.
So if something was not against their particular regional or national interest, they could just torpedo it for everybody. And predictably, it meant that nothing really got done.
Yeah. It's very hard to set up a succession of a charismatic dictator. Obviously, you can't just say, this guy is going to be the new charismatic dictator, because that bureaucracy doesn't work like that. You can't bureaucratically set up someone who rules by force of personality.
Right.
No, so there's really no obvious successor. For example, someone like Milovan Djilas, he'd been purged and exiled in the in the 60s.
He was going to be the successor.
Yeah, he was going to be the
successor. Kind of was for like a week or something, and then just got kicked out when he was he deviated a little too far from the norm
and
of
then,
the ideology.
Obviously, Rankovic isn't an option because he's been purged by this point.
He's been purged as well.
And possibly it could have been Kardel, the Slovenian economist, but he died a year before Tito, so he wasn't an option either.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's this collective responsibility is really the only option. And like I said earlier, you shouldn't assume that is immediately going to be a cause for fracturization. I mean, because obviously there's a much less personality based leadership set up in China after Mao dies, and the Chinese state does not fall apart. It still hasn't fallen apart, even though it's got a very collective leadership at the top.
Right. And I have to give a little bit of credit to Tito too in rubber stamping this possible possibility of a succession. Because it shows once again that he's willing to kind of roll the dice a bit in order to try new ideas. Like after the Tito-Stalin split, he was willing to try a different way to do communism in order to, that you know, something that had never been done before. And this idea, he was willing to be like, well, you know, so far we've been doing one central, strong, charismatic leader, but that doesn't necessarily mean the way that we always have to do it, you know? And so he sets this up. The other thing that it underlines to me is just how much of a privilege it is for many of us in the countries that we live in that are much more stable than this, where, you know, you can have a leader elected that is completely not aligned at all with your own political beliefs or ideology, and it's fine. You know, there isn't an armed insurrection, you know. That is a true privilege of a country that has achieved a kind of stability that is very difficult to achieve. Very difficult.
Yeah.
So what happens when Tito dies then in 1980, basically, is the writing is to some extent on the wall, because as we've seen all through this episode, the national question just kept popping up. They managed to keep a tight enough control on it that it didn't tear the country apart while Tito was in. But once Tito dies, it's not that long until it does start to tear things apart. It would only be about 10 years before the outbreak of the Yugoslav War, which produces the independent states that we have today, not all of which are doing particularly super compared to how it was under Tito. So, Alex, what would you say really went wrong at this point? After Tito dies?
Well, this is the million-dollar question, and it's probably going to be argued about for God knows how long. But to draw the obvious comparison, like I say, with China, for a start, like, Tito does provide this kind of legitimacy for the regime. He is the obvious source of authority and power within Yugoslavia. He's a war hero, like I said, and all the legitimacy of the regime flows from him. And when he dies and there's no single successor, that legitimacy immediately becomes a lot more fractured, and the allegiance of the republics to the state becomes much more tenuous. The difference from to Tito, the way Tito leaves Yugoslavia to the way Mao leaves China, for instance, is, I'd say, twofold. Firstly, Tito leaves a much more decentralized state structure behind him. Mm-hmm. By 1980, when Tito dies, most things are being done at the level of the individual republics. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that while the successors to Mao in China immediately, almost immediately, inaugurate a long economic boom and economic good times, Tito's Yugoslavia, right up to the 70s, has had economic good times. It's been very prosperous. Mm-hmm. And almost as soon as Tito dies, things start to get bad. The economy starts to go down the drain.
Well, that happened a little bit before, right? But with a number of other things that were coming due, like international debts and an oil crisis and various other things.
Mm-hmm. But it really starts to pick up pace when Tito dies. And so the average Yugoslav now is looking at the regime and seeing the initial legitimacy, the war legitimacy for the state has gone. The economic legitimacy of the state to provide for the material benefit of its citizens has gone. And there's no obvious person in charge. And it's not... most of the people in charge are at the level of the republics. So you could blame them, but then it's very easy for them to go, oh no, it's all the central government's fault. It's not our fault, it's those... other ethnic groups.
That's always the card in your hand that you can play at any time.
It becomes very easy for nationalist leaders to gain legitimacy by blaming it on someone else, essentially. There's also, like I alluded to earlier, the drive from the republics, particularly the more northerly republics, to try and gain even greater autonomy over their affairs.
Yep, and old resentments and slights start to be brought back. So, for example, we said earlier that the whole phenomenon of the Ustasi in Croatia is going to come back in a big way. That gets taken up as an atrocity that must be avenged. That had been perpetrated against the Serbs.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
And then also, you know, on a more economic kind of end, as we were saying before, Slovenia and Croatia, having pretty much carried the Yugoslav economy all this time, start to feel like, you know what, I'm kind of sick of having my money go to all these other republics that are not really carrying their weight. Right? And Slovenia is the first one to pull away in the 10-day war, which, as being only 10 days, manages to pull off without a whole lot of slaughter, without a whole lot of the nightmare that we associate with the Yugoslav wars, which it kicks it off, but then it goes on in the other republics and becomes a much more bloody and terrible and traumatic experience.
Yeah. I should point out that between the late 80s and the war starting, Yugoslavia has transitioned to multi-party politics, essentially. The Communist Party, the different... because obviously the Communist Party has been decentralised now, so there's now the League of Communists is what they called it. So there's one central Communist Party, but there's also the Croatian Communist Party and the Slovenian Communist Party and the Serbian Communist Party. And none of them can agree... they can't really agree on anything because we're starting to get to the point where Milosevic in the late 80s starts to try and seize control of the party.
And there's also something about, okay, so just before Milosevic manages to seize control, I read something about, and I wasn't able to go into depth with this in my research, but in contrast to the system where we were saying where Tito set up a collective presidency, there was something going on after Tito where there was like a rotating presidency where each republic had its turn the leader. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the, I can't remember exactly how long it went on for, but there was a council of which had one member of each republic and autonomous province. Mm-hmm. And I don't know I can't remember how long their term was, but it would rotate of who held the presidency and they were, and whoever that person was nominally the head of state. This was really just a sort of chairmanship rather than a...
Right. Yeah, so it's difficult to get things done again. So basically, that's the kind of situation where a new charismatic leader who's strong and able to promote a tempting ideology, such as Slobodan Milosevic, is able to persuade enough people that he's the man to take over, that he is able to seize control.
Yeah. And he's sort of, there's this thing, there's, initially when he, Slobodan Milosevic is initially the deputy leader of the Communist Party in Serbia. And after a riot in Kosovo, he essentially stabs the leader of the party, a guy named Ivan Stambolic, in the back and becomes the leader of the party. And then he sort of manufactures these coups in Vojvodina and Kosovo and Montenegro, and essentially replaces the leaders of the party in those republics with his puppet figures. And that's where you have a point where the other republics start to react against this, and they have this big congress, at which the Slovenian representatives walk out, and then the Croatian representatives walk out in protest, and then the Bosnian representatives walk out, and essentially what they agree as a result of this is to just to open the Yugoslavian politics to multi-party politics. And they have elections, and they have elections in each individual republic.
But even that ends up not being enough, right? Because then you start to get secession, starting with like Slovenia, for example. And now here, it's clearly a terrible analogy, but it's similar enough that I kind of want to get your opinion on it. How would you contrast the situation here with something like Brexit?
I think there's
not the ethnic racism element.
We're too early to say, really. Yeah. if in the coming years we start to see other EU states pulling away, then you might be able to start comparing them. But at the moment, I don't really think you can compare them. Something that might be a bit more comparable from the US perspective. Is the secession of the southern states in 1861. There's a lot of talk about secession, but until South Carolina secedes, no one really ever thinks it's going to actually happen. And then and then as soon as South Carolina does it, the others all follow because they feel their position is compromised. And that's sort of the case with the states pulling away. It's in a very, that's probably not a very good analogy now I think about it, but Slovenia pulls away. Slovenia breaks away because it has no reason to stay in, essentially. And no one in particular wants to keep it in. Then Croatia breaks away because it feels without Slovenia its position in Yugoslavia is compromised, that it will now be outvoted by Serbia on everything, and so it breaks away.
Okay.
And then subsequently Bosnia, fearing that now they are going to be in a Yugoslavia that is essentially dominated by Serbia, they break away as well. And so it's a domino effect.
Yeah, it's a domino or like a Jenga tower where, you know, you take the right block out and it all just comes crumbling down.
And then, of course...
Which brings us back, actually, to our original question. Was Tito really... That single crucial load-bearing block in the Jenga tower that was holding it up all that time, or was it a whole lot more complicated than that? And I think clearly we've seen that there was a lot of complicated stuff that we went into. But really, in the end, what was Tito's role in holding things together?
Well, for a start, I'd say that this Yugoslavia exists for 70 years. If we take out the World War II interlude. Tito is only in charge for about half of that time.
So if we start Tito's reign at, say, like 1945, right? And then we go to his death in 1980. Yeah. That's 35 years, right?
Yeah.
And Yugoslavia.
Well, I'm adding the pre-war Yugoslavia as well.
Oh, okay. Yep, gotcha. So the Kingdom of Yugoslavia is included there.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, I should have clarified that. And
that's okay.
he makes himself integral to it in a way. The way he leaves the country after he dies gives it more structural vulnerabilities than somewhere like China.
Yep.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say he's absolutely integral to it. I certainly think either if the economy if a million things happened, if the economy was stronger, if Yugoslavia had been less decentralized by republic, then it might have survived for longer. Mm-hmm. But Tito sets it up in a way that makes him more essential to the running of the state than he had to be.
In the end, would you say that this is something that everybody's going to have a different opinion on, but in your opinion, do you feel like Tito was too hard on the restriction of freedom of speech when it came to national and ethnic questions? Or was he too easy on it? I mean, we clearly saw, like, once his hand was off the wheel, it pretty much drove into the ditch pretty quickly. But at the same time, had he been any harder than he was, he would have drawn severe criticism from the West for being a very oppressive dictator and, you know, restricting freedom of speech. So, I mean, how do we in the end evaluate this guy?
Well, I think there was a mistake in not dealing with the World War II narratives in more detail. But at the same time, I really don't... There is this popular idea of what's known in Yugoslav studies as the ancient hatreds myth, that there was all of this ethnic tension just bubbling under the surface that was just waiting to break out as soon as Tito dies. And that's just not true. There was... even after Tito died, there was a high degree of ethnic harmony and cooperation. There was a quite prominent book in the field written about 10 years ago now by a guy named Valère Gagnon, I might be pronouncing that wrong, called The Myth of Ethnic War, in which he analysed surveys and opinion polls and social statistics from 1990 in Bosnia, and he concluded that there was an astonishing lack of racism between different ethnic groups, and the more mixed area you lived in, the more tolerant you were likely to be to other ethnic groups. This is really something which is, I don't want to say manufactured, but brought on by nationalist leaders for political gain, I would say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that's the thesis that he pushes, that polarization is something people like Milosevic and Tudjman are deliberately pushing for their own political gain. Because it gives them more political power, it gives them a license to crush and marginalize the opposition to them within their own countries. And it's sort of, Bosnia is the victim of this, essentially.
Hmm. Interesting. That's very cool. Well, anything else you want to say on this topic?
Other than what I've said, I can't really think of anything now. Like the ancient hatreds thesis is a very popular journalistic and political trope. It's in the field of actual studying the Yugoslavian wars, it's taken not seriously at all. It's very harshly refuted and attacked.
Really?
Yeah, it's
interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. All right. Well, that was awesome. Yeah. I think I learned a lot. So hope our listeners did too.
Hopefully, I hope it hasn't been a complete waste of your listeners' time listening to me.
I don't think so at all.
I hope I told them something of use.
Yeah. Anything you want to say about your podcast for our listeners?
Well, basically, I'll just sort of summarize for those who probably have never heard of it before now.
It's new, too.
Yeah, it's quite new. I only started doing it a few months ago. It's basically covering the history of Yugoslavia from the start of the 19th century. We start in 1804 with the first Serbian uprising. And the plan is to go through to probably the end of the Bosnian War, possibly the Kosovo War as well. It depends how long it takes me. And at the moment, we're in the 1870s, and we've just dealt with the war that makes Serbia completely independent. Because at the moment, we're focusing on Serbia. In a few weeks' time, when we've got Serbia up to the First World War, we'll go back and deal with Croatia and, well, sort of splitting it into two halves, the Ottoman half of the Balkans and the Habsburg, the Austro-Hungarian half of the Balkans. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that might have been a bit jumbled, but...
No, not at all. So yeah, listeners, if you want like a more historical, this happened and this happened, this happened kind of narrative of going through the Yugoslav history and from the, all those different perspectives, Alex's show is the place to get it. So check that out. Well, that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening. Thank you once again, Alex, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be back. Yeah, absolutely. Be sure to support the show on www.patreon.com/deadideaspod. And if you do, you get your portrait drawn in the time period and culture of your choosing. Alex, do listeners have a way of supporting you?
Not at the moment, though I am looking into it.
All right. Well, keep an eye out for that.
I will be setting up a Patreon account soon, and there'll be more details on the podcast when I've done that. So.
All right. Sounds good. All right, everybody, we are almost done with our Titoism series. We've pretty much wrapped it up. We'll be back with one more episode. We're going to do an epilogue, just like we started this. We started it with a prologue that was a personal reflection, so we'll end it with an epilogue that's also a personal reflection. We'll talk a little bit more about how Titoism, the idea, went extinct. We'll have a reflection on what it means to have an ethnicity and a nationality, and we'll talk a little bit more about family and really kind of take it out in that personal way that we started this series. All right, I'll see you in 2 weeks, everybody. I'm B.T. Newberg, and this is Dead Ideas.